Hi and welcome to Revision Media with me, Paul Stevenson. On this Monday, the 22nd of March, 2021, welcome to you all, wherever you are around the world listening. Beautiful day over here in London. We are live through here from 3 o'clock, 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Over here in the UK. That is 11 because the time difference hasn't shifted yet, so it's a little bit less behind us here at the moment. That's 11 till midday Eastern Standard Time. Later you can join me on Republic Broadcasting Network with Richard Carey as well in a couple of hours' time. That's 5 p.m. till 6 p.m. UK time, midday till 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So I recorded an interview with Mark Collett of Patriotic Alternative at the end of last week. I'm going to air that today. And Patriotic Alternative is a nationalist group with the interests of the native population, the indigenous white population of the country, and we would affirm that organization, and I would as well affirm the same logic to the European, Western European nations, which have seen tremendous dilution of their peoples and attacks on their peoples and our cultures. So Patriotic Alternative is an organization which has promotes the interests of the native population and the British culture. And his name again is Mark Collett of Patriotic Alternative. So I'll play that interview now. Mark also does a show on Republic Broadcasting Network just before our show on Patrick Slattery's show on a Monday. So you can catch that as well on a Monday evening. That's 5 p.m. till 6 p.m. UK time. So I'll just play that now without further ado. Let's crack on with it. It's about an hour long, so. So let's just see. I think we have Mark with us. Mark, are you with us?
I certainly am, Paul. It's fantastic to be back with you again as well. I always enjoy spending an evening in your company.
Indeed, and you too, Mark. And there's so much to talk about. You know, I was thinking, and I've had a bit of a cold, so I don't know whether maybe I'm thinking clearly, but it seems to me that there's just so much happening, and it's almost difficult to keep up with it. I'm thinking, I mean, we live in an era, you know, in a time of, you know, news feeds and social media and YouTube and mainstream media, and it's very easy to go from one thing to the next, and a week later you forget. But there does seem to be a lot happening and stuff that actually is important. It just seems to be sort of the everything has been thrown at us right now. Would you agree with that, or generally?
Yeah, and things are speeding up. Things are accelerating. I've got to say, they've not let their foot off the gas one bit, have they? Things have definitely got worse and worse. And coming off the back of coronavirus and all the COVID legislation, I was thinking, what's going to happen next? Which direction will they push it from here? But they're certainly not letting up. I think things are going to get worse and worse for us in the coming months and years. And this Sarah Everard case and the legislation that the Conservatives are passing on the back of this case is very, very telling. It's very, very concerning, because you can actually see what they are aiming to do. And what they're aiming to do is capitalize on the groundwork they laid during the whole COVID scamdemic, and then use this Sarah Everard case to take away even more of our rights and freedoms. And in the last few days, what have you seen? Well, we've got a Conservative government. And this is the amazingly funny thing. It's a Conservative government. Well, a Conservative government is meant to be a government of small government, low taxes, and larger individual freedoms. And here we're seeing a Conservative government that's have just in the last few days, made moves to make misogyny a hate crime, committed to £45 million extra spending on street lighting and surveillance, and pledged to put plainclothes officers in nightclubs, bars, pubs and restaurants all over the UK. Now, this is a massive, massive growth of the state surveillance powers. And at the same time as doing that, they have also moved forward with a ban on protests. And that tells you something, doesn't it? This is looking very much like the Soviet Union. I mean, people talk about the Soviet Union. They talk about plainclothes NKVD officers in bars, in public places, listening, snooping, watching, waiting. They talk about surveillance that basically watched every person, peered into the lives of every regular working man or woman. And that is what we're seeing here in the UK. But there's another massive parallel as well. Here in the UK, we've always had the right to protest. Now, they never had a right to protest in the Soviet Union. You couldn't protest. Protesting was strictly outlawed. But along with these new surveillance laws, what have they done? They've outlawed the right to protest. It's absolutely insane, and it's moving so quickly.
It is moving so quickly. It's head spinning. And that's the police crime sentencing and courts bill that you're referring to. This would also give power to the Home Secretary, and the Home Secretary alone, the power to define, in quotes, serious disruption. At the same time, there has been outrage from some of these hypocrites in Parliament who voted for the legislation to stop protests, to give the police these powers to break up crowds, in the name of this coronavirus nonsense, and now they come out because it's a feminist issue, I guess, and a woman's been killed by not only a police officer and a man, but a white man. And, you know, these people seem to be impervious to irony and oblivious to, probably I suggest more, willfully blind to their own odious double standards. Because with this cause, you can protest. It's kind of Black Lives Matter all over again. And you're right, it's this acceleration of things, and it's always a crisis, it's always an emergency. And then you have these bills go through, and some of these things sound like they make common sense, and then you look at the small print, and the small print was, inspired by Stalin.
Well, that's exactly what you've got, because there is one final component to all of this. And that's obviously these new laws that will effectively outlaw misogyny, turn misogyny into a hate crime. And I believe part of the agenda there is to make normal human interactions effectively illegal. So what you're going to have is a situation where a guy wolf whistles at a girl. That's a hate crime. A guy stares at a girl. She feels uncomfortable. It's a hate crime. A guy makes a joke. He makes a flirtatious comment. You might even get to the point where a man is walking down the street. He thinks a woman smiles at him, or she gives him the eye, or they pass glances. And he, nods his head politely and says, "Would you like me to take you for a coffee?" And the next thing you know, she's reported him for a hate crime. And I believe that this is exactly where all of this is going. I believe that they are bringing in more and more thought crimes, more and more speech crimes, more and more legislation that takes away our right to do normal things, to speak about normal things, to have conversations. And all of this is being done at a time when our rights to actually protest against these changes in legislation are being curtailed. I mean, these new laws that prevent the right to protest, they drastically limit the right to protest in front of Parliament. This means you are effectively electing 650 dictators that sit in a building, and if you disagree with what they're doing, you cannot go to that building and voice your opinion. Yet those 650 dictators, they claim a massive yearly wage plus incredible expenses at our expense. It's us paying for these people, but we can't go and voice our discontent at what they're doing. So in the past, you used to see different groups going to Parliament Square. They would protest. They would raise awareness of issues that they cared about. That's all coming to an end. And the thing is, whenever you see this kind of legislation being passed, the thing I always find the most worrying about it is the way it's worded in such an open-ended way. We're not outlawing peaceful protests, says Boris Johnson. We're not outlawing peaceful protests. We're outlawing nuisance protests. We're outlawing protests that cause other people annoyance, annoying protests.
Or serious disruption is the, they always, if you, they control the language all the time.
Well, this is the thing. What's an annoying protest, Paul? What you know, when does a protest go from being a legitimate protest to being an annoying protest? Because when I hear language like that, I can hear them making arguments in court now. Well, the EDL were marching through Birmingham and they were all chanting. This caused major annoyance to shoppers on a Saturday afternoon at the Bullring. Henceforth, the EDL is now outlawed from ever protesting again, and the organizer of this annoying protest is going to be fined X many, you know, £1,000. I believe that that is exactly what will happen. And I can see this being used absolutely selectively. And again, I've got to raise this. I've raised this several times before. But in the 1930s, I believe it was in the 1930s, the British government brought in a new law, and it was the Public Order Act. And the Public Order Act was brought in to deal with Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists. And a central part of that Public Order Act was to outlaw anybody dressing in political uniform in public. So if you went out in political uniform in public, you could be arrested. And this was obviously to stop the British Union of Fascists. This was to prevent the British Union of Fascists from organizing. Now, that's very, very interesting, because last year, around summertime last year, during the BLM protests, there was a group, and I believe they were caught there. I believe they called themselves Family Forever or something along those lines. If that isn't exactly the correct name, my apologies, but I believe it was Family Forever. And they were a black group or a black rights group, whatever you want to call them. They were a group of black activists, and they marched through London in full political uniform. A military style march in unison, absolutely wearing political uniform. They had all black on, they had armbands on, and they had berets. It was clearly political uniform, and it looked highly militarized as well. No one was arrested. No one was taken to task for this. And that tells you really everything you need to know. If a nationalist organization marched through the streets of Britain wearing political uniform in a militaristic fashion and all wearing armbands, I can tell you now, that would be the front page news on every single paper across the nation, every single local and every single national paper. That would be front page news. And people would be screaming from the rooftops, why on earth is this going ahead? Why aren't they being arrested? We have legislation to deal with these kind of thugs. Everyone would be going mad about it. But no one's going mad about this. And the reason no one's going mad about this is because, yet again, you can see this incredible double standard. And I'm telling you this now, if somebody had complained about this and the police had acted, if the police had actually said, look, you're all in political uniform, we're rounding you up, and the organizer of this protest is getting, you know, the fine that any nationalist group would get if they'd have pulled this kind of stunt, I'm telling you now, that police officer who had given those orders and potentially the police officers who took part in the arrests and followed those orders would all have been stood down. They would have been publicly named and shamed. There'd be an inquiry into police violence or something like that. And it would have been absolutely, again, front page news, because they would have claimed that these black activists were being brutalized. And you've got to say this. The entire system that we live in is now clearly geared against white people, preventing white people from organizing in their own ethnic and racial interests.
Yeah, and I think it's becoming more and more clear, even to moderate people. I'm hearing more kind of moderate commentators, you know, speaking about whiteness and bringing this up. And I, at first, when the Sarah Everin thing occurred, I was briefly surprised that they hadn't framed it as a white cop or a white man. And then I paused and caught myself to realize that, well, this would really open a jar of worms that they would, you know, firmly like to keep shut. And you know, this would really let the cat out of the bag, because that would mean the discussion would be a little bit more specific. Because I don't know where you've noticed, but no one has been asking, in the name of all these people who are so suddenly interested about this crime epidemic against women, if they are so serious about targeting it, no one has asked the question, well, who is it? Can we narrow it down? Are there areas? Are there groups of people? It's all been, you know, boiled down to the lowest common denominator of men. But they haven't needed to actually say it, because that would be a risk for them, because you would start talking about, well, let's look at some stats and figures, because it is a white cop. But the other point I wanted to make, this is where this lockdown stuff has led to, because they've got a taste for this crisis, because Mark Drakeford was asked on Sky News if he would support this idea that this genius in the Green Party talked about a curfew after 6 p.m. for all men. And Mark Drakeford refused to denounce and deny it, and actually said that it's something he might consider in a crisis.
Well, exactly. They are driving this agenda, and you can see exactly where it's going. And the language is getting more and more explicit. Mm. The whole idea that whiteness is something that should be tackled. Can you imagine if tomorrow I went on YouTube and did a podcast on why blackness had to be tackled? Not only would I be instantly deplatformed, but I should imagine the police would be knocking on my door later that day.
Yeah, you would, yeah.
And we can't have these conversations. And this is something we should be talking about, because I'm not saying the Sarah Everard case isn't tragic. It is absolutely tragic that this girl was kidnapped and murdered. I feel very, very sorry for her. I can't imagine how terrible the last moments of her life were. I can't imagine what horrors her parents are going through. I can't imagine how bad her boyfriend and her friends feel. This is a terrible, tragic case. But I can't remember when hundreds of thousands of girls were being groomed, sexually assaulted and raped by Muslim men in towns up and down, mainly England, but also other places in the UK as well. I can't remember when any government said, we need plainclothes officers in kebab shops and by taxi ranks in these towns. That was never said.
Or a curfew for all Muslims.
Or a curfew for Muslim men, or more CCTV outside the local kebab shop and in the taxi rank. We need CCTV outside the kebab shops. They never said any of that. In fact, they covered it up and were completely hesitant to tackle it in any way because they didn't want to rock the multicultural boat. Now, this tells you exactly what you want to hear. And it's funny we're talking about this today because I've just finished work on a video and it's called A Tale of Two Murders. Now, this video compares the case of Keeley Bunker with the case of Sarah Everard. Now, Keeley Bunker was a 20-year-old girl from Birmingham and she was murdered on her birthday night out by a man she thought was her friend. This man's name was Wesley Street. Now, Wesley Street was black. He said he'd walk her home. She left the club with him. They began walking home and he dragged her off into a park, brutally raped her, murdered her, dumped her body in a stream and then covered it with twigs and branches. And apparently he returned to the murder scene later on to add a few more branches to the body for good measure, hoping that it wouldn't be discovered. Now, when he went on trial, he didn't just go on trial for the rape and murder of Keeley Bunker. He went on trial for the sexual assault and rape of a 16-year-old girl, the sexual assault of a 15-year-old girl, and the rape of another 20-year-old woman who he met on Snapchat. Now, this guy had been a serial sexual deviant, a serial predator, and a serial rapist before he raped and murdered Keeley Bunker. Yet, when Keeley Bunker was murdered, where was the inquiry? Where were the vigils? Where were the protests? Where was the politicians saying, we need to investigate why this man who started his raping spree in 2015 was allowed to continue raping, sexually assaulting and ultimately murdering British girls up until 2020? Why did this happen? And we know why. Because when somebody from an ethnic minority commits a crime, the police are pressured in many ways to ignore that. And in cases where massive failings in the criminal justice system are exposed, if they are exposed, in the case of something like Keeley Bunker, where a white person is a victim and somebody from an ethnic minority is the perpetrator of the crime, those injustices or those failings in the criminal justice system are never, ever, ever followed up. It's all brushed under the carpet, just like the grooming scandal. But here with Sarah Everard, this is the establishment's wet dream. This is a woman murdered by a white male in a position of authority, and they can weaponize this against the wider population, just as they weaponize the death of George Floyd. And this is like George Floyd part two. And I did a Google search today, and I'm actually going to give you exact numbers here because it's very important that we are on the money with these things. If you search for Keeley Bunker, you get, and this is an exact quote from Google, about 449,000 results. If you search for Sarah Everard, you get 28,700,000 results. That tells you the difference in, let's call it noise, that these two cases make. When a white girl is murdered by a black man who is a serial rapist and serial sexual offender, you get 449,000 results. When a white girl is murdered by a white man who's in a position of authority, you're touching 29 million results. That's the difference in the amplification of the message. And this isn't to take anything away from the horror of the murder of Sarah Everard, but it is to point out clearly that certain cases are amplified so that the system, so that the establishment can use those cases as a justification for new legislation, which invariably is legislation that takes away our rights and our freedoms and places ridiculous restrictions on us. And if you're looking at this legislation in context, we're talking about 45 million on street lighting and CCTV. We're talking about taking away the right to protest. We're talking about plainclothes police officers sitting in bars and pubs watching everybody. And this is all coming off the back of a time when we weren't allowed outside our houses, where the government was prepping the public to snitch on one another, snitch on your neighbours. If you see a neighbour going out and you don't think it's an essential journey, call the police. There's a special hotline. If you think your neighbours are having friends over and they shouldn't be, make sure you snitch on your friends and family if they're breaking the COVID rules. This, or what we've seen over the last couple of years, and the Sarah Everard case totally bleeds into this, is a massive, massive expansion of government power, government surveillance, and a move towards a state where you are monitored not just by the eyes in the sky and the camera, you know, on the side of the building, but you're monitored by your friends, your family, your neighbours, that weird guy sat in the corner of the pub staring at you.
Your sister.
Yeah, everything. This is one of the biggest power grabs the Western world has ever seen. And it's not, and just, and not only is it not being opposed, but it's being cheered on by the masses. And this is the amazing thing about this. Not only are people not railing against this, they're cheering it on, they're welcoming it, they're saying, oh, this is what we need. We need.
Like the coronavirus, not only are they falling for it, they're calling for it.
Exactly. They've got people cheering to have their rights taken away.
I'll tell you what, it's so claustrophobic, it's so depressing. You're right. This is ostensibly the biggest power grab and the biggest display of tyranny that these lands have ever seen. Things have changed, Mark. You can't get away from it. You know, things have changed, and they've changed. Just, it almost feels like they've just changed in the blink of an eye. I've been on the radio for 5 or 6 years talking about this stuff, talking about corrupt governments, talking about tyranny and stuff. But they just made their move with the coronavirus thing. And it's just all been accelerated now, and it's very claustrophobic. And you mentioned there about, you know, the double standards. It was the same thing, by the way. You did a search there for, Sarah Everard, and then you did a search for this. What was her name? I can see, there you go.
Keely Bunker.
Have you, you know, are you even familiar with Tony Timpa?
No.
Okay. Tony Timpa died exactly the same way as George Floyd did. He died at the hands of police, except that Tony Tampa looks like he actually did die at the hands of corruption, rather than, if you actually look at the details of the George Floyd case, the guy had enough fentanyl in his system to kill a rhino. He couldn't breathe because he had so many drugs in him. It's one of the symptoms, if you take fentanyl, is to shallow breathing. It affects your breathing like any those types of drugs if you overdose on them. But Tony Tampa is a guy who was murdered who died at the hands of, you know, kind of aggressive arrest type thing. Never heard of him. And by the way, you might encourage you, or you might be indifferent. I think we're all going to be bedfellows in the end. If we learned anything from the royal family saga, it's why bother appeasing them? They're going to smell blood and have no respect for you. And I think Nigel Farage is realizing that. But he did a video, Lorraine Cox. Have you heard of her?
Lorraine Cox. No, I haven't.
Okay. She was murdered in Exeter, I think it was a couple of years ago, and her body was chopped into seven pieces, I think, and, you know, separated around a certain area.
No, I have. I remember I tweeted about this at the time.
Yeah. And the guy was, I think it was at Asil Mangari or something like that, a failed asylum seeker. You know, and Farage did a video about that, and he actually mentioned that the two reasons probably why this has not been mentioned is because the first one he mentioned is because maybe London's more of a focus, but the second one he did actually go out, you know, and actually say is because the, you know, Sarah Everard's murderer was white.
Yeah, I'm just refreshing my memory on this case because it was absolutely horrific because he chopped her body up, he dismembered her, and basically popped the remains all over the place, didn't he? I think they found her in seven different places.
Yeah,
it absolutely horrific.
I never heard of her until last night, until Nigel Farage did a video about it.
I remember tweeting about it at the time. And this is something else I've got to point out. In the Keeley Bunker case, I saw the Keeley Bunker case, and it was one of those cases that you see so many of these things, but some of them get to you. She was a very pretty young girl, very, very slightly built. There was no way this girl would ever have defended herself. I think she was, it said in the news report, she was only 4'11". She had a whole life ahead of her. And she was obviously told from a young age, you know, you've got to trust these people. These people are your friends. These people are decent people. These people are, you know, on your side. They're not going to hurt. You don't believe the racist lies. And she was forced into the arms of this monster, this Wesley Street, who she trusted. One of the last texts she sent, apparently, to a friend was, Wes is going to walk me home. You know, I'm fine. Wes is... She trusted this guy. And he betrayed her trust. He raped her and murdered her in a brutal fashion.
Yeah,
and
that wasn't his real name either. It was Asil Mangari. He was a film...
Oh,
it's a different guard. Sorry.
About the Keeley Bunker case.
Oh, sorry.
And the thing that got to me about this case was when I highlighted it on Twitter, I got this, I'm not on Twitter anymore, but I got this absolute deluge of messages and tweets being directed at me from these Twitter liberals. Why are you talking about this case? Why would you highlight the case of Keeley Bunker? Obviously, girls get murdered. Men kill women. It's what happens. Why be interested in this case? Why are you magnifying this? Are you trying to make some form of political point out of her murder? And you have to put up with all this nonsense. Then Sarah Everard dies, and every dribbling liberal moron with a Twitter account is tweeting five tweets every 2 minutes, going berserk about it. And these were the people who were telling you not to care about the Keeley Bunker case, that it shouldn't be politicized, that people like myself shouldn't be talking about it. But the Sarah Everard case is absolutely political. And I go on Twitter every now and again to see what's trending. And oh my God, since I've not been off Twitter long, maybe 6 months, but since I've been off Twitter, boy, has it degenerated into an utter cesspit so quickly. I don't think there's any decent-minded people still on there anymore. And when you actually look...
Well, it's a total woke echo chamber now.
It is. Yeah. It is. And you're looking at what these people are saying, and you're looking at their response to this, and these are the same people that said, we should never talk about Keeley Bunker. This shouldn't be highlighted. But they're jumping on the Sarah Everard case, and they are loving it. And you know, if they do put a curfew in place, that curfew, I am telling you, will be for white men. They will never put a curfew on men from ethnic minority communities. And they are already doing this. You already see this, especially in America, where they say, you know, people of color and white women and white homosexuals, you know, they are the in crowd. The straight white male is the group that they are trying to break. We are the ones that are getting smashed repeatedly over the head with this anti-white, anti-male, anti-traditional garbage. We are the number one target.
Yeah, because this has got, as usual, it's got nothing to do with liberating women or keeping women safe, but, you know, sort of destroying our freedoms and increasing that already very large target on the back of white males.
Well, this is the thing, though. we are the people, or we are the only people, I believe, white males are primarily the group that can stand up to the establishment. And they know that. We are the ones that, if we got our act together and we organized, we would be the block that prevented these globalists, these anti-whites, getting their way. And they are doing everything they can to smash us, everything they can to disenfranchise us, everything they can to break our will. And this Sarah Everard case is going to criminalize so many normal interactions. So a couple of guys are sat in a pub, two girls walk past them, and one of the guys goes, "Oh, look at the legs on that, mate." That's going to be a hate crime. That will be a hate crime. One of those girls, she texts, you know, the police helpline and says, you know, I'm sat in the Stag's Head now. There's two guys sat opposite me. One of them made a comment about my legs and he stared at me, smiling at me. I'm feeling uncomfortable. And, you know, if there's not a plainclothes officer in there to arrest him on sight, you can be sure they will be sending a squad car to the Stag's Head to drag that young lad out. And God forbid if some young lad propositions a woman or says that she looks nice or offers to buy her a drink or is looking at her the wrong way, or just a woman feels uncomfortable because a man smiled at her. You are going to have a situation now where approaching a woman in a public place will essentially open you up to criminal action. And I'm going to tell you what this reminds me of. I've got a friend, and he's a very, very talented guy. He works as an engineer. And when you work as an engineer, you can basically pick your wage and you can work any way you want in the world. And he spent time working in Saudi Arabia as an engineer, actually teaching students in Saudi Arabia. And he said to me, when he was out there, they had something called the religious police. And the religious police had the right to arrest people that they felt weren't following Islamic rules or Islamic teachings. And he said there was a case where one of the young men in his class didn't turn up for class one day because he'd been arrested by the religious police. And he'd gone to a cafe and he bought a coffee and he passed the time of day with a woman that he didn't know. And in Saudi Arabia, you're not allowed to go up to a random woman in the street. You can go up to your, you know, your mother, your sister, somebody who's in your family, but you can't just approach a woman that you haven't already been introduced to. And this guy was arrested and he was taken in by the religious police. And that's why he wasn't in class that day. And what you're going to have here in the UK could well be something very similar. Young men, you know, a young man in a coffee shop, you're dressed very nicely, or I like your hair, or you've got a lovely smile. Can I grab you a coffee and a donut or something? And boom, that's it. She calls the police, and you're not taken in by the religious police, but you're taken in by the special hate crimes unit that, you know, wants to ask why you have committed this misogynistic crime against this poor woman. And really, you've just been trying to have a normal human interaction. Are we, and at the bottom of this, when you really boil it all down, are we actually making normal human interactions illegal here?
Not only that, but making it abnormal. And it's an interesting comparison, because I've been saying for years that cultural Marxism is a religion. It has all the hallmarks of a religion. It has its dogmas and doctrines of inclusivity and no tolerance for intolerance and diversity. It has its priestly class, which are the celebrities, the Oprah Winfreys, the Meghan Markles, the David Beckhams, you know, and it has its heretics. Anybody who basically steps outside of the dogmas and the doctrines, they get treated like heretics, and you might not get burnt at the stake, but you lose a job, you could be thrown in prison, you'll suffer ostracization, and that's where this is headed. And it's been headed this way for a long time, but it's just this exponential acceleration of it since this coronavirus thing. And also, you know, I worked in advertising for years, and 90% of advertising is aimed at women. And it's aimed at women for a reason, because women are more pliable, they're more open to suggestion, and you will have girls almost overnight with a Sarah Everett thing questioning those occasions when they felt nice when a guy looked at them. And maybe the guy said hello to them and they weren't threatened, or they maybe had butterflies because they felt attractive, like young women like to do or women like to do. They're going to be questioning themselves now, thinking that they've been part of this patriarchal structure and they are actually victims. And I was out today and there was a couple of girls. I swear, I was scared to make eye contact with them. I just looked away every time I saw a girl. I didn't want to look anywhere near them, you know?
But that's how they want you to feel. And it's interesting what you said about the coronavirus, because I think a lot of this coronavirus legislation, a lot of what they did throughout the coronavirus, because as you know, I'm a coronavirus skeptic, to say the least. I'm not saying there isn't a disease. I'm not saying the coronavirus doesn't exist. But I believe that the response to the coronavirus, especially here in the UK, was absolutely disproportionate. But I believe that was done for a reason. The people in charge aren't idiots, and that's a mistake that a lot of people make. You often hear people, the uninitiated, often say things like, oh, well, I can't believe it. They're all just a bunch of fools. How have we got these idiots in charge?
How can they be that stupid? You know?
Yeah, how can they be that stupid? But they're not stupid. They're very, very clever. They're very, very devious. And I think that a lot of what was done during the last 12 months was a dry run. I believe it was a test. I believe it was an acid test to see how far they could push it and to what extent the British public would accept a complete police state, how far they could go taking away our freedoms and our rights, and how much we would accept it. And you can see that not only have many, the majority of people have accepted it, a tiny minority have pushed back, and a sizable minority have cheered on what's going on. So you've maybe got 30% of people cheering it on. You've got 60% of people who probably don't really agree with it, but will go along with it because they don't want to, you know, step out of line. And then you've got 10% who will push back against it. So the government are saying, we need to neutralize 10% of the public. 30% are going to cheer. 60% will get in line. Let's get rid of this 10%. And they are going to now move forward with getting rid of that 10%. The 10% of free thinkers who oppose them, they've all got targets on their back now. And they've seen that as they take out those 10%, 30% will cheer and 60% will be sat at home quivering, saying, oh, thank God I didn't say anything. Look what they've done to that 10%.
Yeah, and not only the state and all their tentacles of new powers that they've got, but, you know, that other 30% and even some of that 60% will be targeting the 10%. This is why it's very claustrophobic, you know. And again, it's just like it seems to have happened so quickly. And I really, really feel it at the minute. You know, I was listening to something on UK Column News the other day, and I just looked out of my window and I thought, this is really bad now, you know. This is not talking about what's going to happen. This is here now, you know. And I it's difficult to even sometimes make plans, you know, as to, you know, what I'm going to do in 3 or 4 years' time with my business and everything else. And I mean, also, can you even fly out of this country now without having to have a vaccine? I mean, they, you know, they're so clever. I mean, if you look at communist countries, they build walls to keep people in. But now, under this guise of public health, unless you take the vaccine, you can't get out of here. You know, how many airlines are there now will let you fly to America or wherever without taking a vaccine? Not very many, I don't think.
But it really goes deeper than that, doesn't it? Because it's not just about whether you take the vaccine. They're now saying if you take the vaccine, that doesn't necessarily stop you getting the disease.
Yeah,
if it doesn't stop you getting the disease, you have to be quarantined when you come back for 14 days. Well, I'll ask you this. If you and your wife want to take a weekend break to Florence, is it actually worth it? Can you be bothered for a weekend in Florence if you're going to have to spend 2 weeks when you get back at your expense in the Holiday Inn, proving that you're not going to, you know, you're not going to turn into the COVID monster or whatever happens. You know, that's what it is, isn't it?
Not kill everyone who gets within 2 meters of you.
Exactly. This is the absurdity of it. So it makes it absolutely untenable to go on holiday. And you can say, well, okay, well, if you go away for 2 weeks, you may be able to spend 2 weeks in a hotel then. You could go away for a longer break. But no, that doesn't work either. Because if you're an average guy and you get 20 days holiday a year plus the 8 bank holidays, well, that means a 2 week holiday burns every day you have off that year other than the bank holidays. It gives you no wriggle room. It gives you no time for an emergency day off. You're ruined. So no one's going to do it. Basically, what they're saying is, because of COVID, you are trapped. Because of COVID, you're stuck. Now, the only people this will allow to travel is the global elite. Because I'm telling you now, the global elite will fly wherever they want. They will get back and they won't be staying in the Holiday Inn or in the 2-star hotel where you wouldn't really want to stay normally. That's like an emergency stopover place next to a hotel, next to an airport or on the hard shoulder of a motorway. People don't want to stay those places. The global elite, they will have special places. They will stay there and they will be able to travel. Or they will have special private doctors that will certify them when they land on their private jets. There will still be travel for the people the government want to travel. But Joe Public, the average man on the street, it's going to be him that stays at home. It's going to be him that gets banned from traveling. And you know that, again, this is the system. And what you're going to have here is basically a two-tier society where there is going to be this tiny percentage of people who are uber rich, in with the government, in with the media, in with the financiers that can do what they want, and everybody else is going to be treated like cattle.
Yeah, that is where it's headed, basically. And again, as I say, it's got there.
And I've got to make, can I make one more point about this? Because during all this, there was one thing that I noticed, and it was done by the Daily Mail, by the Sun, by basically the tabloid press. Now, during all of the COVID lockdown, there was a number of people who call themselves Instagram influencers. And these are usually very pretty young women and very fit and in shape young men. And they make money from posting pictures of themselves on holidays, basically, and they pose in bikinis or pose in their swimming shorts or they're doing exercises or diving to the pool. I'm sure you're aware of the kind of people I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And during this, these people all fled to Dubai and to nice holiday places and said, we're gonna live out the lockdown in Dubai, or we're gonna live out the lockdown on holiday. That's where we're going. And they got on the last flights out of Britain and they escaped. And during the latter parts of the lockdown, all of the tabloid press ripped these people to pieces. All the tabloid press attacked these people and they turned the public's anger on these influencers. So it's like, sick influencers, Lord, the fun they're having in the sun as we're trapped in their homes. Mm. You know, callous influencers, enjoy another holiday while you sit in homeschooling. You know, the gall of Instagram influencers who want you to like their posts as you sit at home. Now, I could see what was happening there. All of the tabloid, because lots of people at home were angry, and the tabloid press said, get angry at these influencers who have managed to get out and go to Dubai or have a holiday or aren't stuck in lockdown in Britain. Mm-hmm. But answer me this. Why should anybody have been angry with those influencers? People should have been angry, all right, but not with the people who got out, with the government who had kept them locked in. And this was a classic example of the tabloid press directing people's righteous anger at the wrong target. So everyone was raging at these 20-something good-looking people out in Dubai.
Enjoying some freedom and sun.
Yeah, when they should have been raging at the politicians. Because I'll tell you this now. Okay, it might not have been the most socially conscious thing to do to run off to Dubai in a crisis. But it sure as hell wasn't these influencers who kept everyone else locked in their homes. It wasn't the influencers taking everyone's rights away and getting their neighbours to spy on them. That was the government. But the tabloid press did everything in their power to make sure that the British public never turned their anger on the politicians, which is exactly the group of people we should be angry with.
Absolutely, because, you know, when people talk about the pandemic, the pandemic was never a problem. It was the government's response to the pandemic and everything the government did. And, I mean, let's try and wrap it up, you know, maybe in 10 minutes if we have, because we haven't even looked at the economic destruction that's coming down the tracks. I mean, it's completely inevitable that none of the central banks now are going to raise interest rates. You have in the United States it's probably the worst because they have the world reserve currency. So basically they're producing less and less and they just keep printing up dollars. And, you know, Jerome Powell, the Fed chairman, came out the other day. This guy, I mean, talk about psychological warfare. His response to, you know, questions about concerns about inflation was, oh, not only is there no concerns about inflation, but we're struggling to get, you know, inflation above 2%. I mean, this is like literally being, you know, in a ship which is sinking with the water up to your chest and the captain's going, I'm struggling to get some water in this ship. That's the problem. And that's what this guy's saying. And so they're going to destroy the dollar in the United States. And you know, Rishi Sunak and everyone thinks that this furlough's great and our government's great. This is going to be the most expensive free lunch ever served. They've obliterated almost the private sector. And guess what? It's not just a neutral thing when you destroy the tax base like that, because that tax base will then have to be, you know, paid for somehow. And they either go in the dole, or more likely, if they don't want to go in the dole, well, the state can offer them a little Soviet-like snooping job. We've got plenty of jobs. We need some more cops in pubs, you know? These are the types of jobs that are going to be created. Meanwhile, the currency's getting devalued. Inflation's going to go through the roof. Anyone with any savings is going to lose the value of that currency. And this is yet to come. We've talked about this two-tier system where they're taking away our civil liberties in that form. But when you're struggling and you are suffering from poverty, I mean, you are even more decapitated, you know?
Well, that is another thing. And I find it amazing because yet again, the people in charge have messed things up for normal people, for normal folk, for the working people of this country. And who's going to pick up the tab? Oh, well, it's going to be the working people of this country. That is who will be picking up the tab for all of this mess. We are going to see normal, decent people basically paying the price for this.
For what they never wanted and protested against in the first place.
Exactly. So the government have said, you've got to be locked down. You've got to have your businesses ruined. You've got to be placed in this situation. It's for your own good. Whether you want it or not, you're going to have it. You're going to have it. That's how it is. You're going to take it. You've got to take it on the chin. There's no two ways about it. That's that. So the public have taken it on the chin. And now they've said, you know, that thing that you took on the chin that you didn't really want? Well, it kind of cost us a lot more money than you'd have thought it would. So if you guys wouldn't mind picking up the tab for that, and it sounds absurd, but that's what's happened. If I can draw a quick analogy, it's like being forced to go to a restaurant, being forced to sit down at the table. The waiter comes over and says, there's only one thing on the menu. It's a dog poo sandwich. You're going to be forced to eat it. And you sit there, you hold your nose, you spend an hour slowly chewing your way through this dog poo sandwich. And when you're finished, you're about to get up and leave. And the waiter dashes over and says, "Sorry, mate, you've not paid your bill."
And not only that, but everybody else in the restaurant who've actually been enjoying the dog poo sandwich, you're paying for theirs too.
Yes. This is the mad world that we're living in. And people will keep accepting it. And I think by the end of this, the Daily Mail will say, "Boris was the man who brought about Brexit. He was the man who beat COVID." You know, he was the man. I'm sure he'll be the man that stuck up to the woke bullies as well, just to win people over even more. And it's all so, so very, very tiresome. And I would love to say to you now, Paul, that I am confident that the people will finally see through this. And very soon we will be in a situation where the people will be having no more of this. But come the next election, it'll be exactly the same as it's always been. It'll be, are you voting Tory? Are you voting Labour? And the same people who have, told us to vote Tory at every election ever will be telling us to vote Tory again. And the same people who've been telling us to vote Labour for every election will be telling us to vote Labour. And the public will be sat there thinking, well, you know, was the dog poo sandwich tolerable enough under the Conservatives for us to keep voting Conservative? Or do we think Labour would make a slightly tastier dog poo sandwich that might be a bit cheaper? And that's the question that the electors are going to be asked. And as funny as this analogy is, sadly, it's true, isn't it? This is exactly how things are going to play out. And people will keep accepting this garbage. And it's an uphill battle, but we have to keep working to wake up that 10%, unify them, bring them to one cause, so that hopefully in the years to come, we can motivate that 60% who didn't like this but didn't have the guts to say something into actually thinking outside of the box that they've been placed in.
Yeah, and as you say, it's going to be an uphill battle because none of us had foreseen this lockdown scenario where it's difficult to even meet. And we spoke about that in the last video with the pubs being targeted and that probably been, you know, very deliberate and, you know, groups wanting to meet and have that human interaction because it really has dispersed people. It's done a similar thing. I mean, I'll be honest with you. The local church I went to, it's not a liberal church or whatever or anything like that. It's a little local evangelical church. The ignorance was off the chart. I completely ended up losing my rag with the whole leadership, if you could call it leadership, in the church. Didn't have a clue. I told them they should never have locked down. They should take a stand. You've no idea where this is leading. And they've just all been absorbed by this whole culture thing as well. And I mean, I'm not going to lie, Mark. It does get lonely. It's okay. I'm talking to you now and I appreciate these conversations and I appreciate having a radio show that I can talk to people like you and others and do interviews like that. But they're very few and far between, you know, meeting people that, you know, who, even if they are aware of certain things that care that much, they care about their children, they care about the future of the country, you know, and I find this even in the leadership of the church. I was like, you say you're supposed to love people. You're supposed to care about people. Well, tell them the truth then. Take a stand. But they just went along with the whole thing, hook, line, and sinker. You know, it was so disappointing, really. But I don't know why I was disappointed because, you know, the church has been, you know, on the slide for so long now as well. Even, you know, sort of Bible-believing, you know, evangelical churches, you know?
I do feel that the church at times like this are sadly so desperate to prove that they are in with the woke agenda or whatever the government's pushing, that they are as good as useless. And it's very, very unfortunate because at one time people would have to some degree relied upon the church to actually take a stand. They would have used the church as a place where they could come together with like-minded people and make a stand against this madness. But instead of that,
I tried. They just thought I was a madman and a sort of a troublemaker, you know?
Yeah. And I've got to say this as well. The church's sort of acceptance and embrace of the woke anti-white nonsense, it amazes me. And it amazes me because when you're selling a product or when you're trying to get people to attend an event, whether that be an event you pay for or whether it be just getting bums on seats at the church, you have to think about the kind of person that attends your event or buys your product. So if you're selling off-road mountain bikes, the, you know, really rugged off-road mountain bikes for flying about down the sides of mountains, and you're making an advert for that that product, you're not going to make it to appeal to pensioners with brittle bones, are you? You're not trying to appeal to 75-year-olds because they don't want to be hurtling down the side of the mountain on a mountain bike. You're appealing to young men and probably a small amount of young women too. Now, the church should know that they are appealing, or their primary appeal is going to be to traditionalists, to, you know,
A counterculture.
Yeah, that exactly. They're not going to appeal to Marxist, pink-haired feminists who wear upturned crosses. They're not going to be appealing to black youths who want to be grime stars. They're not going to be appealing to snot-nosed anti-white atheists. They're appealing to people who are traditionalist, conservative with a small c. They're appealing to people who love freedom, love the British way of life, love freedom of speech, want to have freedom of association. That's who their appeal, that's who their message should be aimed at, because that's who they can primarily appeal to. But it seems as if the church is hell-bent on doing everything in its power to essentially upset the people it can appeal to and desperately attempt to appeal to people that it will never appeal to in a month of Sundays.
Yeah. And and unfortunately they fall for everything and stand for nothing, because there is scriptural mandate, and you know, to have a counterculture. The Jews killed Jesus Christ for that very reason. And you know, there was, and I tried to appeal to my pastor in this way. I said, you ought to be mindful that Trotsky and his buddies in Russia in the early 20th century, after they overthrew the Tsar, they murdered and slaughtered all the church leaders in Russia in within 6 months. So these people hate the white race. And they hate real Christians. But the problem is, the church is not, a lot of the church today in the West is going to be safe enough. They're just going to get a little pat in the back because they don't stand for anything which is a threat to them, you know?
What they will do with the church, in my opinion, is keep pushing it down this like nonsensical woke route.
Absorb
until,
it. Yeah.
Until it's at the point where it's so weak that they can do away with it. So they'll weaken it. They'll drive people out of the church. They'll ensure that normal, decent people would never want to go to church, until the churches are so empty that when the state says we're doing away with it, there'll be no one in them to defend them against, you know, the Marxist stormtroopers. It'll be as simple as that, because I've said this before, and I know there's a lot of people who support our cause who are pagans and who aren't Christians, but you have to draw inference from what our enemies are doing. Our enemies are hell-bent on ridiculing, mocking, undermining, and destroying Christianity. And they're not doing that because Christianity is or has been historically bad for us. They're doing it because Christianity has been a uniting force for white people in the past and has been a moral barricade against the sea of amoral or anti-white filth that is now washing over us. So they're destroying the church and they're destroying Christianity because it is something that they believe may well, at one point or another, get in their way if it wasn't undermined and destroyed.
Yeah, and you know, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, are you familiar with him? He was.
I certainly am.
Yeah, one of his greatest quotes ever, you know, was basically, and it really sort of hits the nail on the head of everything. And he said, driven by ethnic hatred, he said they hated Russians, they hated Christians, and they committed the greatest slaughter, I'm paraphrasing, in human history. The fact that this slaughter is not talked about is proof that the global media is in the hands of the perpetrators. And, of course, in the background of a lot of this is the perpetrators who own the global media, who are still driven by ethnic hatred and, given the chance, would slaughter even more white Westerners and Christians today.
Exactly. I couldn't say that better myself. That's a superb quote. And at the moment, you can see just how true that is, because as all of this attack on white society intensifies, as we see these attacks on whiteness itself intensify, the media are cheering them on. The media are rubber stamping them. And even so-called conservative newspapers such as the Daily Mail, despite the fact they might let out some tiny grumbles about what's going on, they never ever present a solution, do they? They allow there to be a small amount of grumbles so that people can say, oh, there's somebody on our side, but they never offer a solution to the problem. And you can see how our enemies control the so-called right-wing press to actually make things far worse for us. Because there's nothing worse than people thinking that they are being listened to, thinking that they have somebody on their side, when in fact they don't. And I think definitely the Daily Mail is one of the worst for that. And another guy that's terrible for that is Piers Morgan. Piers Morgan is basically, you know, he is the guy that he's wheeled out every time the public want to think, oh, there's somebody on our side. Did you hear what Piers Morgan said about the issue? And Piers Morgan will always say what the establishment need him to say at any given time.
Yeah, he's a complete controlled opposition, herding people and providing some false hope. I have to say, though, I am noticing some, and even though they would still fit into that category, it's become so obvious now, you know, that I was even quite shocked that Farage did that video last night, because that sounded more like the type of thing that we might do a video on or talk about in a radio show than what Farage would talk about. To even mention, to bring up that comparison with that girl who was chopped to pieces and why the media weren't talking about it. So, you know, someone like Farage, he seems to be, you know, it's a bit like the royal family. These people, and I remember saying this years ago about the JQ, it's like, stop trying to appease these people. Stop saying you're not racist. Stop trying to say, there's no evidence of this, that, and the other. It doesn't matter. They'll just smell blood, and they'll smell weakness, and they are right. You are weak, because they see weakness in that, and they will stamp on you even harder, because I don't know why, but they just have no respect for that kind of weakness. So why bother, you know?
Well, no, I completely agree. The only thing I'll say about Nigel Farage, and I always sort of smell a rat when he jumps onto any of our talking points, and the reason I smell a rat with him is because I think sometimes he says things not because he actually believes it. I think sometimes he says things to court controversy. If he hasn't been in the press enough recently, he will say something to get himself in the press. And I'm always... like at the moment, one of his biggest battle cries has been that the British vaccine is the best thing ever. And we should all be taking the British vaccine because it's made in Britain. And, you know, we should be so proud of, you know, this is our kind of last imperial stand, you know, that we can make a vaccine and we should all be behind it because it's the British vaccine. I mean, it might give you blood clots. It might sterilize your women. It might cause little boys to, you know, testicles to wither, I don't know, but as long as it's made in Britain, we should be supporting that because that's what Brexit's all about. And I just find Farage quite irritating, especially his support of Tony Blair recently, that Tony Blair should be in charge of the vaccine rollout, because if any man could do it, Blair could. You know, what was he thinking when he said that?
He's a bit all over the place. That's the problem with him. He's just a bit all over the place. He's I don't know. He can't seem to make his mind up about something. Sometimes you think, yeah, right on, Nigel. You know, there's a bit of hope for you. And then other times you say the Tony Blair thing was a disaster. Listen, two quick points. Sean Bailey, who likes to present himself as some sort of, you know, savior of London against Sadiq Khan.
Oh, yes.
Even he, who, you know, at times at least has been dog whistling, you know, to more in quotes conservatives in London, he came out in response to this police crime sentencing and courts bill and tried to defend it, saying, but listen to the language, quote, "These powers are necessary. If you see what is happening in London, we have a crime epidemic." So we always have these epidemics now and pandemics, and this is the way it's all framed. So that's Sean Bailey. And I thought I would end on a more positive note, because I don't know whether you saw David Davis's speech in Parliament yesterday.
No, I didn't.
Okay. Well, it is a pretty damning report of collusion, and even used the word conspiracy up to, you know, high levels in Scottish government with the whole situation with Nicola Sturgeon.
And I didn't see the speech, but I read about it this morning, actually, in the press. And I did think it was very interesting that he had used his parliamentary privilege to go on a full out attack like that.
Yeah. And if that doesn't bring that woman down, then we are living in an even more degenerate, immoral, unprincipled, you know, system and nation than I even thought, because a lot less would have brought that woman down by now. And, you know, the hubris of that woman, you know, there's a quote in the scriptures, you know, "He who exalts himself shall be humbled," you know, "and he who humbles himself shall be exalted." And I was going to do like a sort of a funny skit with you at the start, you know, could you name your top five, you know, most irritating politicians? And the five that I had on the list were Nicola Sturgeon, Boris Johnson, Keir Starmer, Matt Hancock. But I decided on my number one was Sadiq Khan, followed by Nicola Sturgeon. And I mean, that really is saying something. So if she falls, and if that corruption that people would call us conspiracy theorists for suggesting that she's been interfering in the criminal process and that whole process going on there, then that does provide some hope, I think, you know, because she has to be one of the most hubristic, despotic little upstarts that I've ever had to witness, you know. And they've brought in that hate crime up there for a reason.
That's scandalous.
Yeah. So that is actually something positive. But, you know, again, you know, you get cynical, it'll probably, you know, she'll probably continue regardless, you know.
Well, I'll be very interested to see what does happen there. I'm certainly not holding my breath, no. But she does seem to be up to her neck in it. And what she did to Salmon was absolutely horrific, especially considering what he did for her.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know why she... I'm at a loss to why she did this to him.
I think these people, and I think Khan is the same, and I think Matt Hancock is the same. I think these people, they are such narcissists, and they get so high on their power that it's like they really think that they are untouchable. It's like they are gods in their own mind, where they really think that they are so protected that they can ultimately do what they want with impunity, and that, you know, no normal rules of justice or reality applies to them, you know, because these are the types of, people that are attracted to politics today. You know, you look at the moral degeneracy, even in that field alone of politics, say in the last 50 years, I mean, wow, it has fallen, you know, to just levels you never would have thought possible, you know.
I've got to agree. And I think that One of the instances for me that really, really highlighted this was when Matt Hancock went on Good Morning Britain, and he was literally laughing about the coronavirus situation, pretending he was crying. And the next day, the newspapers were like, oh, Matt Hancock cries with relief that this is all going to end. Mm. You could see he was laughing.
Yeah.
He was laughing at the British public for buying all of this. And that tells you everything you need to know about this man. And you're right, he is one of those, you know, slimiest, you know, political operators that's just absolutely detestable in every single way. There's nothing you can say about him that is good, is there? He's not a good man in any way.
No, and you could, yeah.
He's just despicable.
You could imagine him, couldn't you? You could imagine him behind closed doors to, you know, if he had a bad day or if he got slightly embarrassed on an interview. You know, you could imagine him having, you know, people locked up in a basement somewhere going down to take it out on them. I mean, this guy is a psychopath. I mean, there's something even beyond kind of your average, you know, corrupt politician about him. There's something not right about him, you know?
Well, I couldn't possibly comment on that.
But that's the feeling he gives me. I could just imagine him bullying everybody and making their life a misery, even in his own staff or whatever, if he's had a bad day, you know?
Yes. Well, as I said, that's one of those things I'm certainly not going to comment on, because I think that could, commenting on something like that could get me a visit.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, mate, listen, we'll wrap it up there. But yeah, we've covered a lot of stuff on there. And as always, it's great to speak to you, Mark.
Thank you so much. It's been a really, really enjoyable evening. And I look forward to working with you again in the future.
All right, mate. See you later.
And on that note, folks, yeah, I thought it would be appropriate to finish up there. Some sort of positive note. It is very sobering. As Mark said, it's, you know, we've got to be realistic about it. It is going to be the same old nonsense at the next elections, Labour, Conservatives. But as he said, that is the hope. That is the one of the strategies to try and reach the 10% and get them organised and try and wake up some of those other people who will be suffering more and more as these lockdowns continue. As their businesses are continuing to be destroyed, as they suffer the fallout of that, people are getting sick and tired of these lockdowns now. We have a bunch of oligarchs and special interests trying to basically control the whole population. Well, you can fool some of the people all of the time, and you can fool all of the people some of the time, but they are seriously attempting to fool all of the people all of the time. And you cannot suppress human behavior the way they've been doing with these lockdowns. So I'll leave it there. That was Mark Collett from Patriotic Alternative. As I say, he's also on Republic Broadcasting Network on a Monday evening at 5 p.m. UK time, which is 11 p.m. Central Time normally, midday Eastern Standard Time. And I'm sure I'll have Mark on again. So until then, folks, I'll be back again next Monday, same time. I think our clocks will have changed by then, so it'll be 4 p.m. till 5 p.m. UK time and 11 p.m. till midday Eastern Standard Time. So I will also be on Republic Broadcasting Network in 1 hour with Richard Carey on the Beyond the Official Narrative show. That is 5 p.m. till 6 p.m. UK time, midday till 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Okay, take care. God bless.